This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And hopefully we'll push up camera one there. Hello. Oh, Bernie was with us on Wednesday, so today is just anything goes Friday. If there's anything on your mind, anything you want to talk about, there's a lot that's happened throughout this week. Yesterday, for the next 3 hours, it's you and me. At the end of the day yesterday, at the end of our program yesterday, the president, in fact, John Kerry had just finished his speech on the Iran deal. And predictably, I said, I hope that the Republicans will come out and say, hey, peace in our time, wouldn't that be a great thing? Wouldn't it even be incredible if the President of the United States won the Nobel Peace Prize or something for this? But I predicted that the Republicans would instead trash it, and by and large, that's what's happened. With the odd exception of Bill O'Reilly. Figure that one out. Meanwhile, the Koch brothers and Americans for Prosperity, which is really seriously challenging the Republican Party, are up to their old, new, interesting tricks. Tana Geneva, writing over at Alternet, this was a couple of days ago. The headline, this red state almost expanded health insurance to 280,000 poor people. Then the Koch group got involved. Right, that would be Americans for Prosperity. It starts out, Tana Geneva writes, Tracy Foster calmly explains that when she goes to the doctors, all they can do is poke her bladder back into place because it is falling out of her body. She has bladder cancer. She needs to have surgery immediately. The doctors all agree, but she doesn't have insurance and can't get the operation unless she hands over $8,000 up front. $2,000 for the doc, $6,000 for the hospital. She doesn't have that kind of money. She doesn't have a health plan to cover it. So she went to the Tennessee legislature. They were debating what they called an expansion of TennCare. This is Tennessee's version of Medicaid. And they even rejiggered this thing. The Medicaid expansion, which these red state governors have been turning down, a few of them have figured out how to, it started out as, I think it was called the Arkansas model. They figured out that there was a way that they could expand Medicaid that was consistent with Republican values. Now, just so that everybody understands what we're talking about. If you make more than, let's say you don't have a job. You're just broke. You might make a few hundred bucks a month here and there or whatever, but you've got no income. If your income is below $2,000-$3,000 a year in Tennessee, or pretty much anywhere else in the country, the state-based Medicaid program will pick you up. Well, she earns a little too much for that. She says that she was dropped because her daughter turned 18 and is an adult with no dependent children. She's no longer eligible for coverage. Apparently, in Tennessee, you can even make nothing. Who knows? But in any case, so there's, for the very, very profoundly, deeply, incredibly, insanely poor people, there's this little bit of Medicaid available from the state. And then if you make over 100, and I think it's 138% of the poverty line, which, as I recall, is in the neighborhood of around $18,000, $19,000, $20,000 a year, something like that, then you start qualifying for Obamacare subsidies to buy health insurance on the Obamacare exchanges. But in between, if you make more than $2,000 or $3,000 a year and less than that $15,000, $20,000 a year, there's nothing for you at all. And there's nothing for Tracy Foster. And so what Obamacare does is it says, hey, to the individual states, we will pay for those people 100% of the cost of it for the first 3 years, 90% of the cost of it for the rest of time. We will pay for those people. You no longer have to pay for them. And all the blue states have said, cool. And, millions of people are covered with Medicaid now. But in the red states, they couldn't say, okay, fine, we'll just take, tax money, government dollars, and give it to poor people. Republicans can't do that. It's not in their DNA, at least modern Republicans. Dwight Eisenhower used to brag about that Modern Republicans, no. So what they've done is they've figured out a way to expand Medicaid, but still retain fidelity to their Republican values. The principal Republican value being that this party is owned and run by rich people. And we take the positions that the shills for the rich people speak so that the suckers will continue voting Republican. And the rich people, frankly, don't give a rat's ass about the health care for poor people or the working poor. A and B in particular, they don't want their tax money used to pay for it. So the way that they get around this, the way that Republicans have been getting around this, and the Republican governor of Tennessee thought he had this figured out, is they take this and they got a waiver from the Obama went along with this. They get a waiver from the Obama administration to do this. They say, okay, great, you're going to give us X millions of dollars to pay for poor people's health care. Rather than simply taking the money and giving it directly to the hospitals and the doctors, which is typically how Medicaid works, it's a single payer system. Instead, we're going to take that money and we're going to give it to for-profit health insurance companies who will skim their 10, 20, 30% off the top so that they can kick back campaign contributions to Republicans. And then those companies will provide the health insurance to the so-called Medicaid recipients. Now, fewer people will get insurance. There will be co-pays associated with the insurance. There will be higher fees for the insurance. It's going to be a tougher deal for poor people. Because after all, the CEOs of these insurance companies have got to continue making their literally hundreds of millions of dollars. They've got to pay for their multiple mansions and for their corporate jets and all this kind of stuff. But at least it's a way that the federal money can come to the states and help poor people. So it seems logical. And the guy who's, you know, the governor of the state, he thought he had it all figured out. And then... And Tracy Foster and a whole bunch of other people went and testified on behalf of this, even though it's still kind of a crappy plan. Suzanne Lanier, a grandmother for Insure Tennessee, she said, reality isn't reality until it happens to you, pointing out that the legislators who might scuttle a plan are among the lucky Tennesseans who have state-backed health insurance. 77-year-old vet Ron Huddleston made a sharp point about Christian values. He said the people who run this building consider themselves to be conservative Christians. I always thought the definition of a conservative Christian was one who followed the teachings of Jesus Christ, such as help to feed the poor, feed the hungry, heal the sick. I thought that's what Jesus said over and over again. Well, yeah, actually he did. So it was all set to go. And then Americans for Prosperity comes to town and starts running ads. The day of the Moral Monday protest, Tennessee's chapter of Americans for Prosperity, the conservative advocacy group, David Koch, heads the AFP Foundation, had relaunched, I'm reading from this piece in Alternate by Tana Geneva, had relaunched its radio campaign against Insure Tennessee. So they're running these ads going, Obamacare has been a disaster. Expanding Obamacare in Tennessee will be the same. Right. In other words, they just did this advertising blitz and totally intimidated the Republicans in the House or Senate in Tennessee. And so this expansion of Medicaid died. And so Tracy is in, you know, with bladder cancer, is in all probability going to die. Now, there is starting to be a little bit of pushback to the Koch brothers, and we will get to that in about 4 minutes, 5 minutes. I want to share with you what a Florida legislator had to say about them. But, you know, I wanted to set this up. I wanted to let you know what's going on. And this is not just happening in Tennessee. This is basically any red state that has not yet taken Medicaid expansion. If they try to, if they think about it, if even in ways where the money gets skimmed off the top and goes to rich people, it ain't going to the Koch brothers. Americans for Prosperity will kill it, or will do their best.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. It's Anything Goes Friday. Give us a shout. We'll cogitate on pretty much anything today. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Along the lines of other interesting things, Neil deGrasse Tyson created his own new Pledge of Allegiance and, you know, laid this out on his TV show. He said on Thursday, I pledge allegiance to the truth. He says, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the divided states of America and to the PACs, the political action committees, for which it stands, one nation at odds, divisible, with liberty and justice for some. And the right-wingers went insane. They went nuts. Which raises a really interesting question in my mind. Was it the paid shills for the rich people who were trashing Neil deGrasse Tyson in Twitter and telling him, you know, to leave the planet and other things far more obscene than that? Or, I mean, because all he did was he pointed out that this country, that our democracy has been corrupted by political action committees. Now, I don't think that's, I mean, arguably it's a partisan statement. You know, we had Craig from Public Citizen on the program day before yesterday, and he said that, you know, these transparency proposals like all federal contractors have to disclose their lobbying and politicking activities, or which the president could sign, and that's the one that they delivered yesterday, the 500,000 petitions to the White House. Or where is Mary Jo White, you know, getting the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission to say any publicly traded company has to disclose their politicking and lobbying activities. Now, I would go so far as to predict that if either one of those essentially executive orders got signed, they would immediately be sued and it would go to the Supreme Court and they'd be immediately stayed, but at least get the process started, right? So anyhow, the question in my mind is, when Neil deGrasse Tyson pointed out that America is basically, you know, in the hands of these wealthy billionaires, these PACs, you know, and that we're a divided country and we're being divided by these PACs, like Americans for Prosperity, like look at what they did in Tennessee. That was it. Was all this blowback the consequence of true believers? I mean, are there that many of them? Has Fox News been that effective? We do a lot of stories from MediaMatters.org. They, you know, every single day over there, you can see the crap that Fox is putting out. I mean, stuff that's just plain old flat out not true. But has that produced enough people that there's like this a national groundswell of hate for a guy who simply points out that the political action committees are corrupting our politics? And shouldn't quote conservatives or independents or libertarians or whatever these folks call themselves, shouldn't they be saying, yeah, Neil, you're right. We need to fix this? Or are they just so, do they actually believe that everything that the Koch brothers and Shelley Adelson and the other billionaires funding the Republican Party, everything that they're pushing is somehow going to benefit working people, particularly lower-income working people? I just find the whole thing astonishing. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Happy Friday, the 3rd of April. My calendar clock is right here. Black Friday? Why is that? Oh, it's Good Friday. Oh, that's right. It's the Friday before Easter. That's right. So this is Holy Week. So for those of you who are really into that all that stuff, I wish you happy Holy Week, or however you say it, happy Easter. And is it the first night of Passover tonight, too? May well, Troy thinks so. Maybe. Aha. Okay. The one sheet says so. It must be if Sean figured it out. So happy Passover also. But back to my point that I was saying earlier. This the Koch brothers have created this Americans for Prosperity thing, and Americans for Prosperity now have ground operations in every state. They have done the Howard Dean strategy on the right. Only they're not calling themselves Republicans. They're calling themselves Americans for Prosperity. And they've become this really, really powerful pressure force. They succeeded in Tennessee in destroying the possibility of low-income people getting getting free health insurance through Medicaid. They just stopped that. 280,000 people will not be able to see the doctor in Tennessee because of the efforts of Americans for Prosperity and the Koch brothers. So down in Florida, something similar was going on. Down in Florida, the state of Florida over the years has, in a number of different ways, basically subsidized the education of people in how to become filmmakers. Florida had, and continues to have, a thriving film and television industry. And to support that industry, you know, you got a lot of people who got trained and educated in how to do film, how to do special effects. I mean, it's not even film anymore. It's all digital, but you get the point. And they were holding a hearing in Florida, in the Florida legislature, about whether to put together whether to invest a little bit of state money in a program that would help the graduates of these classes get jobs in the film industry or the television industry, in media. See, it was, you know, relatively non-controversial. And then Americans for Prosperity shows up. And this Republican, and I don't know Florida politics, so I don't know who Nancy Dietert is, other than that she's a Republican from Venice, Florida. And she's a member of this Senate committee, the Tourism, Transportation, Tourism, and Economic Development Appropriation Subcommittee. And this Americans for Prosperity guy comes and says, no, we're opposed. And I believe succeeded in killing the thing. But here's where it gets really interesting. Listen to this Republican. She may be the last Eisenhower Republican in the United States. Listen to what this Republican member of the Florida legislature said to his face to this guy who was, you know, one of the shills for the Koch brothers, you know, is a part of that three-part party of the Republican Party, the billionaires, the shills for the billionaires, and the suckers. And she was not taking it. This is just absolutely fascinating. Here is State Senator Nancy Dietert.
Well, let me just say this.
Actually,
I appreciate the mailouts you do against me on a monthly basis that say that I give money to Hollywood moguls, which, of course, I don't have any money to give, and neither does the state of Florida give money to Hollywood moguls. You're called Americans for Prosperity. You're all on the Koch brothers' payroll. Good for you. I'm glad you're employed because it's jobs, jobs, jobs here in the state of Florida. So I hope you're getting paid a lot of money to show up at these meetings and say meaningless things. Obviously, you're for prosperity for yourself and not other people in the industry. We have over 100,000 people in the film industry in the state of Florida. We have multiple film schools where we educated these kids. They would like to now work in the state they were probably born in. And you people serve absolutely no purpose. So keep sending out those mail outs. My fans appreciate it.
Apparently, she's one of the, quote, rhino Republicans, you know, which is what they, you know, in other words, she's an actual Republican, an old-fashioned Republican, and Americans for Prosperity wants to take her down. I think that's hysterical. Last thing I want to share with you, and then I'm going to just pick up your phone calls and we'll cover, yeah, actually, I've got a few other news stories here, but we will filter them in throughout the day as we go on, but then just after I finish with this one, we will pick up your phone calls here. This is about the Atlanta teachers cheating scandal. And I just want to share with you a note that was sent to me by a friend of mine who lives in Atlanta, who is involved in local Atlanta politics, he's actually a historian, and he knows what's going on down there. And, you know, these Atlanta teachers, I mean, they're facing 30 years in prison in the state of Georgia for cheating on standardized tests. In the state of Georgia, if you kill somebody accidentally, you get 5 years. If you kill somebody intentionally, you get 10 years. These people are facing 20 years in prison. 30 years is if you kill somebody with malice aforethought, first degree murder. But simple murder, 10 years. These people are facing 20 years. So my friend down there, I haven't gotten an email back from him in any case, he says, if you cover the Atlanta teacher cheating scandal convictions and impending prison time, a travesty. Remember that it was all due to a racist Republican Bush plot that generated millions for conservative candidates. In the Republicans' quest to gut public education, especially for minorities, they used a since-discredited Houston school plan down here in Atlanta as a way to use testing to ensure cuts of funding of already underfunded public schools, particularly in poor neighborhoods. The architect of the Houston plan became Bush's Secretary of State. He was the guy who said PTA members were terrorists. Testing committees, companies made millions and, of course, contributed to Republicans. In Atlanta, the top school official who oversaw the cheating, Beverly Hall, was not the preferred candidate of the liberals or the civil rights leaders. She was supported by the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce, the leaders of which, of course, send their kids to private schools. So teachers and principals at schools in poor areas were put in a no-win situation where they either had to see their neighborhood schools close and lose their jobs or cheat on the standardized tests. So it's yet another racist Republican scandal the mainstream media gives the Republicans a free pass on. Instead of going to jail, as they should, the Republicans keep going to the bank. Sigh. Right. Okay, that's my stuff. We'll pick up yours right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Bernie was with us Friday, or Wednesday, excuse me. Today is Friday, so it's Anything Goes Friday. We'll pick up your calls right after this. Twenty 8 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday. And Doug in San Francisco. Hey, Doug, what's on your mind today?
Oh, howdy, Tom. Actually, it's David.
But, David, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, you're right. It is David. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I got to check my list. Hey, you know, I was kind of interested in the, you know, if you look at the Koch Brothers Industries and their various lists of all of the products that they make, mining and polluting is basically one of them. Surprisingly enough, they make a lot of picnic supplies. And so whenever you go to a picnic, a big organized picnic, you're going to get Dixie cups and paper towels and all this sort of stuff. And if you've ever driven through parts of North Carolina and Georgia where they have a paper mill, and you just got to get out of that valley faster and faster because the stench of all of that, a paper mill is one of the most god-awful stinks
yeah,
you could
ever
imagine.
Yeah, it's an awful sulfury smell. It's
Yeah. And so the Koch brothers are some of the biggest polluters in the world, and they have a vested interest in actually killing the people that they've poisoned.
That's pretty strong language.
No, it isn't, actually. If you, I for 12 years, I worked for a company called Jury Verdict Research, and studies have been shown for decades, if not, you know, a century or so, that if there's a lawsuit against you, if you're in a car crash and you've left somebody injured, if you drag it on until they die, you're going to end up paying off their heirs 10% of what you would have had to pay to them for their lingering illness or injury.
Yeah, I saw the asbestos companies try to do this with my dad.
Yeah, absolutely. So they have a vested interest in killing the injured people, whether it's on their assembly lines, the miners, the neighbors down the river that they've polluted, that are drinking this foul mix. They have a vested interest in killing the people that they've injured. And so for them to actually go out of their way to destroy Obamacare, so to speak, they're going out of their way with a vengeance in killing their injured customers, let's say. And so it's I've got to look at these things as a RICO statute, you know, the organized crime, to actually go out of their way to ruin the lives of the people that they've injured, the innocent parties. Koch brothers to me are not only saboteurs, but they're traitors. And they've now created a whole philosophy that we the people are we're too proud to accept health care from some big government that we have to just go and die underneath a bush as a proud loner.
Right.
They've basically created that kind of mythos, and the idea that it's some sort of a pride in America to go die quietly rather than sue those famous capitalists that are the saviors of American tradition.
Yeah, David, they didn't invent this idea. I mean, they're currently the major funders of it and the principal spokespeople for it, and Bernie does a great job of pointing out back in 1980 when David Koch ran for vice president on the Libertarian ticket, all the things that they specifically called for, like ending Social Security, ending Medicare, ending the minimum wage, ending unemployment insurance, all those other things, ending public education, ending the EPA, doing away with it. You know, you're right on all those points. But, you know, my concern is that if we vilify just these two guys or the people that work for them or both, what we're missing is that there's a much larger kind of philosophy worldview that's associated with this. So you can track back to Ayn Rand, who I doubt ever met David or Charles Koch. And in fact, you can track all the way back to arguably to Alexander Hamilton. So, you know, what I'm saying is,
you know, it's interesting you mentioned the 1980 convention or the 1980 Libertarian run. If I remember right, wasn't that Pat Clark that he was? Pat Clark was the guy that was running for president, and David Koch was the vice presidential candidate. And if I remember right, that was when I first became of age to vote. And so I was kind of interested in the variety of different political parties. And if I remember right, Pat Clark had actually bought the rights to the Libertarian Party. And it wasn't that he won in some popular acclamation. It was that he bought his seat on there. And so it was that they had privatized the party.
Yeah.
And so when you look at the Koch brothers having a tax break to create all these nonprofits, we the people don't need to give a tax break to polluters to tell us why we like to be polluted.
Right.
That's no common good.
This is why what Lois Lerner was doing was the right thing, looking at these nonprofit applications carefully from both the right and the left to make sure that they're not just about electioneering.
They're actually facilitating the deaths of people that have either common claims as a class action or as an individual civil claim.
Yeah.
These people are polluters, and they're taking advantage of our tax status, our nonprofit charity tax status laws, and creating a phony argument which facilitates the deaths of people.
Right, and we all subsidize all. We're subsidizing Americans for Prosperity and all these other not-for-profits. David, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. Kevin in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Well, since it's Anything Goes Friday, I wanted to keep something from going down the memory hole in that the actions in Iraq and Afghanistan were never a declared war. It's something that came up when they tried to persecute some of those contractors for war crimes, and they said, oh, well, it was never declared a war. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And, congratulations to Obama. Thank you for having voices like Bernie Sanders, who I listened to yesterday. I think that averting World War III is a wonderful thing. Hooray, Obama. And, the more I hear about this deal, it's like when you to hear Netanyahu come and say, well, not a single centrifuge is destroyed. Yes, but they have a restriction on only using 5,000 and the oldest one.
Yeah, Netanyahu's been kind of reduced to, you know, the guy who's yelling on the sidelines, jumping up and down, you know, with a sign in the crowd kind of thing. It's very sad. Kevin, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Mike in Denver. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about the money in politics. It's created apathy, and we talk a lot about move to amend.
Right.
And amendments, and as we know, are hard to accomplish. If we had our legislators legislate accepting anything but public funding for campaigns as a felony or as a crime, wouldn't it accomplish the same thing? I mean,
it would, but the Supreme Court has already ruled that that would be a naked violation of the First Amendment.
And encourage more common candidates to run.
Yes, and Arizona and Maine both put into place public funding for election systems, and the Supreme and it, they got sued. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said that that's a violation of the free speech rights of rich people to buy political candidates.
So this is why Move to Amend is the first step, you're saying?
Yep, absolutely. There are so many secondary, tertiary, quadriary, whatever it is, consequences of this doctrine that money is protected by the First Amendment, spending money is protected by the First Amendment, and that corporations are protected by the 14th Amendment. There are so many consequential side effects of this that has to be the place where we absolutely start. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Mike from Mike to Mike in Lomita, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, good morning. Happy new puppy day.
Thank you.
Yeah, I guess this is another entry under Paige Hills who show up to say meaningless things. Last week during Senator Sanders' segment, there was a fellow who dropped an oral libertarian bumper sticker, which was that Robin Hood didn't rob the rich, he robbed the tax collector. I guess this is a reference to Representative Ellison reintroducing the Robin Hood tax on Wall Street transactions. But that's what he said is the equivalent of saying fish don't need water. They like it extremely wet because both in historical and folkloric terms, in the age of Robin Hood, the rich and the tax collector were the same guy.
Right. Or the tax collector was, to use the language that I've been using, was basically the shill for the rich.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
And the historical antecedent of the legend, in fact, were Anglo-Saxon freedom fighters who popped up after the Norman conquest and were so troublesome that the sheriff of Nottingham and York, which was one post in those days, had to move about with a small army just to protect himself.
Hmm. This after, what, 1099, the Norman invasion? Am I remembering it right?
66 was the invasion.
1066.
Yeah, so this was later in the same century when this sort of thing started to pop up.
Yeah.
And the modern, cultural phenom of Robin Hood started basically in the 19th century with Sir Walter Scott's
book,
which is where we get everything that we accept as Robin Hood today.
Right. Fascinating stuff. Mike, thank you for the call. I gotta tell you, we have the smartest listeners and viewers on Earth. It is such a pleasure to hang out with you guys. We'll be back. Anything goes from.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman program. You can drop by into our live free chat room over at TomHartman.com. And welcome back. Tom, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Waterloo, Iowa. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, on your opening topic, one thing to point out is that, okay, with the money going from the general tax fund to the insurance companies and then to the people, well, the insurance companies are not going to take that money and put it aside for a rainy day. They're going to take that money and they're going to turn it over as many times as they can in the investment banking industry and then pay their bills. I mean, I've been through this rigmarole before. Somewhere along the line, I'm sure some of that money is probably going to work their way back to the Koch foundations and the American for prosperity, to the Americans' prosperity. I mean, this is pretty common. I'm wondering, where are the fiduciaries in this whole thing?
Yeah. To answer that question would require some level of detailed knowledge of exactly how TennCare was put together, and I don't have that. I know the principles, which have been done in Alaska and I believe in a couple of other Republican states, which is, take the money, run it through the corporation. But I don't see how running federal Medicaid money through United Healthcare, it's going to certainly help Stephen Hemsley and, the billionaire who's the CEO there. But I don't see how that helps David and Charles Koch.
Well, I mean, somewhere along the line, if they decide to invest a little bit of that money in Coke Industries, I mean, I'm sure Charles and David would mind.
Yeah, there are, you know, there is, if you go to the website theyrule.net, it's pretty shocking how interconnected so many of these boards of these publicly traded companies are, although Coke Industries is not publicly traded, which is something that we have to, you know, keep in mind. So, yeah, very interesting stuff. Tom, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Chris in Las Vegas. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hey, Tom. I read about this teacher scandal in Atlanta. I think it was probably 3 years ago in a Think Progress article. And it had come out that the American Federation of Teachers had actually sent out like a whistleblowing, like an official memo to Beverly Hall that this is what was going on, because the teachers were going to the unions going, this is like a systematic thing. We're going to go down in flames.
Right.
But they, it's the right to work for less system is set up in Georgia, is that they, you know, the American Federation of Teachers are essentially powerless. They can't collectively bargain.
Right.
And so it's kind of like they couldn't come to the table and go, hey, we think that these, you know, draconian policies of, you know, requiring teachers, you know, there's so much pressure going on, they couldn't strike. And so the teachers were just kind of between a rock and a hard place. They couldn't collectively bargain, yet they wanted to keep their jobs. And the only way that they could do that is to cheat.
Right. And it's a real tragedy. I mean, this is a deep and profound tragedy. And as my friend pointed out, this goes back to these racist Republican plans to destroy public education in minority communities, particularly the inner city of Detroit, or excuse me, of Atlanta, and thus, you know, and turn basically poor neighborhoods into money making opportunities for private for profit charter schools, and it's just and this is what, and thanks for the call, Chris. This is you know, it's being promoted by the Gates Foundation kind of folks. It's being promoted by the administration, Arne Duncan, all this other stuff, and it's not working. Testing is killing people. Testing is sending people to jail. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
Okay, well, just thinking about everything that's going on, it's the oil, stupid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these Koch brothers, I love what David said in the beginning, your very first caller.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, listen to what you were saying yesterday, because I listened to the show and you was talking about Bush and Cheney have blood on their hands. The Koch brothers, they have blood on their hands. And it doesn't matter who they hurt. You know, if they can draw a case where they're being litigated till a person dies, they don't care. They don't care about who they hurt. And you know, right now what they're doing is they're actually trying to stop these talks that Obama has with a very moderate, or I would say probably liberal, leader of Iran. You know, whenever they complain about Iran, they haven't even mentioned that they have a new president.
Yeah, I don't know that Americans for Prosperity or the Koch brothers have weighed in on the Iran deal, although, you know, typically they're part of the Obama can do no right thing.
But. Okay, but I'll tell you why. I think they have, and they're doing it through their surrogate, Tom Cox.
Mm.
Because right now, with the sanctions, there's no Iranian oil, or at least not that much on the market.
Right.
I was looking at CNBC, and they said it would actually, after the sanctions were lifted, it would actually take them a whole year to get their oil on the market. But, you know, once Saudi Arabia flooded the market with their oil, oil prices went down. So imagine if we do come up with peace talks and we do come up with a deal and the sanctions are lifted. All that does is draw more Iranian oil on the market, flood the market, and their prices will go down. So yes, they have a direct hand in what they and what the Republicans are doing. There's nothing being done as far as getting jobs or moving this country ahead with this Republican Congress or Republican Senate. So the only thing they're doing now is fighting a culture war. We don't need a culture war. We don't need to know about. We know there's no Christians being, you know, harmed or whatever they're trying to say right now. We need jobs.
Yeah.
And there's no, you know, there's no leadership coming from this. There's nothing productive like a Democratic Congress or a Senate would try to, you know, try to move ahead. So that's the problem. We need to stop looking at all of these little fights that they're trying to bring up as far as culturally and ask them, what about the jobs? And get the oil companies from, you know, funding all of these senators in Congress, and let's get some real people in there that wants to do the work to move this country forward.
Yeah, you're right, Charles. At the end of the day, it's all about the money. And in the case of the billionaires, it's all about the money. And frankly, you know, for the middle class and working poor people, it should be. I mean, people need to get it that the number one agenda of the Republican Party and of the rich people that control it, own it, and the shills who speak on their behalf, the number one agenda is to make rich people richer. Is, you know, now they want to do away with the estate tax, stuff like that. And the only reason that they're talking about things like, hey, let's make it so that, you know, some cake baker in Indiana doesn't have to sell a cake to a gay couple. The only reason they're doing that is to bring along the suckers. Spot on. And your point about the oil, I think, is very well taken, Charles. Thank you. Thank you for the call. Matt in East Jordan, Michigan. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hey, Matt.
Yeah, I'd like to return to something that you brought up, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, basically asking where this country is. Is it more oppressive than when you were younger? Is it almost more fascist or whatnot? And I'd like to kind of approach this from asking you the rhetorical question, which you're not supposed to do. What would have happened in Germany, let's say 35, 50 years down the line, had the Nazis actually won? And they got past the, you know, pathological, crazed bloodletting phase. And I'm afraid, you know, you'd have something like what you have developing in the United States, you know, almost proto-fascist society. If you look at our incarcerated population or our bloated military budget or whatnot, our priorities, our lack of concern for each other at this point, I think that we're, you know, becoming more and more like a fascist society, and I think this is exactly what would have happened in Germany if you would have had some kind of stability.
Yeah, I've often thought about that. Having lived in Germany for a year, and you know, I knew some of those old Nazis, and I think you're right. The Hitler death cult could not survive another generation. It might have made it a generation. It might have made it into the 50s or the 60s or even the 70s. But then it would have morphed into something, and it probably would have morphed into something that was basically, you know, generic authoritarian government. You know, something like, I don't know. Turkey is not quite that. Turkey is a little more democratic. But there's, you know, lots of countries around the world. Well, Singapore, for example, highly authoritarian, but the trains run on time, as it were. You know, nice, clean. The capitalism works fine. And so they would have morphed into good old fashioned fascism. With regard to the United States, I'm reluctant to use the word fascist just because people think it means Nazis, and it doesn't. You know, it's the real fascists were Mussolini and Franco. But we are definitely moving in a corporatist direction. In fact, I would say that we're already 80-90% of the point there. When you look at the study that just came out of Princeton University just a month or two ago that showed that what the top 1%, what the top 10% want is more often than not what gets passed through the legislatures of both the federal government and the states. Whereas what the vast majority, what the bottom 90% want is it's completely unpredictable whether it will pass or not. It's random noise. There's no correlation between how strongly the people want something and whether or not it gets passed. That correlation only exists for the desires of the top 10%. And Page and Gillens, I think, were the authors of that piece. And, you know, which raises the question, is the United States even still a democratic republic, or have we become a full-blown oligarchy? And is Americans for Prosperity, is this a symptom of the fact that we're no longer a democracy, we're an oligarchy, where they can walk into Florida and do the, or they can walk into Tennessee and take down TennCare, which is supported by the majority of Republicans in Tennessee, as well as the majority of the people in Tennessee. This is not a good moment in the history of the United States. That said, a lot of the not good moment times that we've had, like the late 20s, early 30s, for example, Those were the times when real social change, or the late 60s for that matter, when real social change, or early 60s, real social change actually happens. Matt, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Second hour of our program. It's Anything Goes Friday, taking your calls on the topics of your choice, along with a few of mine. This whole Americans for Prosperity, what they're doing, how they just blew up 280,000 low-income people in Tennessee getting health insurance. It gets even stranger than that. Turns out that there was, in fact, I printed this and then I forgot to grab it. There was a state legislator in Tennessee who was confronted by a protester, is the right word, an activist, somebody who was, you know, speaking out on behalf of there being, you know, expanding Medicaid. He's bringing it over here, Rich. I'll just grab the whole thing. Thank you very kindly. Whoop, there we go. And his name, the activist was a fellow by the name of Damian Crisp, and he goes to Republican State Senator Todd Gardenhire, who is a wealth manager at Morgan Stanley, in addition to being a state senator, and, you know, confronted him about it and asked this guy, don't you get free health insurance from the government? I mean, you're a state senator. At which point, and are you going to give it up? At which point, Senator Gardenhire said, he turned around and said, I'm not giving it up, you, and then he referred to the fellow by an anatomical part of the body that is where solid waste leaves us. He says, I'm not giving it up, you blank. He says, or he might have said, why don't you give it up, you know, words to that. But anyhow, he says, I have it, I don't use it, I use Morgan Stanley's insurance, which is far greater. Jeez, really? And then this fellow says, the person who was in favor of expanding Medicaid, he says, we drove all the way to Nashville, up to Nashville, and tried to engage in the process. And this is the democracy we get, being called a bad word. But the Koch brothers went out, you know, full out, full bore. And, you know, expect to see more of this. We have an election coming up in a year and a half. And, boy, the power of money in this country right now, it's scary. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind?
Yeah, Tom, very scary.
Yeah.
Very scary indeed. You hear me, Tom?
I do. I hear you fine, Wayne.
Okay, yes. The only thing I have to say about these people, like what the Republicans did in Tennessee, for instance, the CDC knew that for the last 13 years, at least minimum, that MMR vaccine causes cancer. All these doctors who are trying to hide the fact that certain cancers can be cured. People like those doctors that fired Jerry Lewis from the muscular dystrophy telethon because he went to them with the proof that there's a cure for muscular dystrophy. The only thing I have to say about all these people is you can escape in this life, but you will not escape in the next life. There's a price to be paid for your actions in the next life, and you will not escape. But this is what I really called you about, Tom. When I said to you a couple of weeks ago that there was a air traffic controller at the Kiev airport the day that plane was shot down in Ukraine and that he was tweeting live in real time, Did you ever look that up?
I didn't. I'm sorry. I did not. In fact,
okay.
I will make a note right now to do so, okay?
Right. When you look it up, you're going to find out that it was actually the Ukrainians who shot that plane down, And also this lie being perpetrated that the Russians invaded Crimea.
Yeah.
Those are the two premises for all the sanctions against Russia. Those two things are the two premises.
Right.
But the thing about it is the Crimeans held a vote, a referendum, and 95.7% of the Crimeans voted to join Russia. So the two premises...
Well, no, hang on just a second, Berwain. They voted to ask for a higher level of autonomy. They wanted federalism. What the problem that they had was that their governors, their mayors, their city councils were all being appointed by Kiev rather than locally elected. And so they wanted a system like we have in the United States where you elect your local mayor, the local folks elect the local mayor and that kind of thing. Now, the local mayors and the local governors would have been more friendly toward Russia than toward Kiev, but they still would have been part of Ukraine in that referendum, if I'm remembering correctly.
Well, actually, they did not want to be.
Oh, you're talking. Ukraine. Wait a minute. You're talking about Crimea. I'm talking about Donetsk. I'm sorry. You're right.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. I'm talking about Crimea.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. I'm sorry.
I'm not talking about Donetsk. I'm not talking about inside Ukraine. I'm talking about Crimea. The Crimeans voted 95.7% to be with Russia.
Right.
So these two premises that the United States, NATO, Europe, those two premises are the premises for their whole sanctions that they're doing against Russia, and both premises are lies because the Ukrainians shot that plane down. If you look at those tweets, you will see it because the Spanish air traffic controller was at the Kiev airport when they shot the plane down, and he was tweeting in real time. The only reason why he got away with his life is because when the Ukrainian military came into the air traffic control facility, they did not know he was tweeting in real time.
Hmm.
Okay?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll look it up, Wayne. I'll check it out. But I would add, it almost doesn't matter. I mean, whether that Malaysian Airlines jet was shot down by the Ukrainian Air Force or whether it was shot down by surface air missiles that were in the hands of the pro-Russian rebels. It's really a kind of a punctuation mark on a long, long paragraph that has, you know, that goes back to the original dissolution of the Soviet Union and the agreements that were made between Mikhail Gorbachev and both Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush to never have NATO on the border of Russia, the absolute assurance that we would not put NATO in Ukraine. And what are we trying to do right now? We're trying to bring NATO into Ukraine, and surprise, surprise, they're freaking out.
Right. See, they promised Gorbachev that they would not move east of Germany.
That's
period.
Right. Yeah, and already, you know, we've taken in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and now, you know, it's Ukraine. It's like at a certain point, I think it's almost like the reverse of the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, we were all upset that they were bringing their weapons 90 miles off our shore, and now we're asserting the right to put our weapons literally on their border.
Exactly. Exactly, Tom. Okay, Tom, I'll let you go to the next caller. Thanks, man.
Okay, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you, Doug. Or excuse me, Wayne. I got Doug in my head today. Brian in Schaumburg, Illinois. Hey, Brian, got a minute to the break. A quick one?
Hey, good afternoon. Yeah, real quick. You know, you spend a lot of time railing on Republicans in the right wing. But the truth is, hardly anybody in your audience is going to vote in the Republican primary. You know, what we really need to look at is the Democratic Party and all of its problems, because most of the people that listen to you will vote in a Democratic primary, I hope. But you need to talk about people like Chuck Schumer, the senator for Wall Street. You rail on the banksters, but Jamie Dimon calls himself a Democrat.
Yeah, I know.
You know, we have
tremendous power.
The most popular Democrat in America. He's done more to shaft the American working class than any Republican.
I don't disagree, and he had an incredible amount of power during the first Clinton administration. And, you know, we'll see where this goes. But the fact of the Brian, if you listen to the program regularly, you know that my number one recommendation is that people show up at their local Democratic Party and don't just vote. Show up and volunteer to be a precinct committee person. Those are the people who pick the candidates, and those are the people who write the platform. So you can take over your party.
This
is the Tom Hartman Program.
And that is what progressives need to be doing. It's the exact same thing that the Tea Party did with the Republican Party. Progressives need to be doing it with the Democratic Party. Take over the party. And welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour. John watching Free Speech TV in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring to your attention a group called Represent Us, and they're pushing this American Anti-Corruption Act. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not.
Oh, okay. Well, it's also to get money out of politics, and they're doing it at a state and local level, and then they also want to do it at a national level. And I had people sign petitions yesterday at the University of Minnesota, and they seem pretty well organized. I won't read you the act because it's really very long, but the gist of it is that they want to stop political bribery and secret money and give every voter a choice. And they claim that this is constitutional also. So
within the context of recent Supreme Court decisions or in the abstract?
I couldn't tell you.
Because that's, that's the key to the whole thing. You know, it's, I would assert that, you know, much of what the United States Supreme Court has done over the last 15, 20 years has been highly unconstitutional. It's certainly been highly unorthodox. And
right.
And we're back to the Lochner Court. I mean, we haven't had a court this hard right since the Lochner Court, since the court of the 1920s that struck down child labor laws and you know, said that
right.
said that the right of a union to unionize was unconstitutional and all those other kind of things. So,
you know, I think people in this group are also supporting Move to Amend and public citizen.
Yeah, Move to Amend is really, you know, part of a large coalition. And trying to be as much as they can, you know, a center point for that coalition. There's obviously some competition in that.
It was
world.
Very interesting. I mean, just the reaction of people. I was sitting with two young people, and you know, they were hawking it to other students at the student union here at the University of Minnesota. And you know, I mean, it sounds like something that everybody would be interested in. Republican, Democrat, do you want to get corruption out of politics?
Right.
But people just kept walking by. You know, there's just a lot of apathy.
Well, I think part of the problem, John, is you never know what's really going on. I mean, it's
inside people. Yeah.
You know, well, it's not just that. I mean, it's
We also took a banner and we bannered 35W, which I thought was a lot of fun. And I just wanted to put my plug in for activism. It's really kind of empowering.
Yeah.
And the two people that were most involved were Indian Americans. They were from their parents were from India, and they have a long tradition of being political activists.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much part of the culture, you know, that it's almost an expectation that people be involved.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. Maybe because they, you know, they really had to fight to be
to become a democracy, right? And
yeah.
India is the world's largest democracy. And
so, you know, between these two and then, you know, Sharma Sawant, I think, really single-handedly introduced $15 an hour, which the Democrats have kind of taken that up.
Yeah, just passed 9-0.
Minimum wage, but she was the first one to do it. So, you know, there's a lot of power in individual initiative, and
I agree. This is the inside-outside game. The last caller was saying, what about the party? I was saying, get inside the party and take it over. You're talking about movement politics, and we need to be doing that, too, and participating in movement politics and pushing politicians. John, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech. We'll be right back. Friday, as we continue here with the Tom Hartman Program, and Doug in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Doug. America is a
yes.
great country.
Tom?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, first of all, I want to say you're absolutely brilliant. I agree with 99% of what you say.
What?
But I've heard you say on at least two occasions, and I quote, America is the greatest country on God's green earth. Now, my question is this. Given the many, many things, many, many, many things that are wrong with this country, stuff that you talk about every day, do you feel that America is still the greatest country on God's green earth? And if so, I'd like to hear your thinking on that.
Sure. God's Green Earth is not a construction that I typically use, Doug, so you might be quoting somebody else. But I certainly have asserted that the United States, in some ways, is unique and exceptional. And I think that that's a point that is worth discussing. And here's my take on it. We are not the greatest country in the world in terms of our ability to educate our citizens. We're not the greatest country in the world in terms of our ability to provide health care to our citizens. We're not the greatest country in the world in terms of building out infrastructure and modernizing. We're not the greatest country in the world in terms of political freedom. We're not the greatest country in the world in terms of the ability of people to be socially mobile, to move from one economic class to another through the course of their life as a consequence of their own hard work and opportunity. We once were, by the way, in virtually all those categories. We are not the greatest country on earth in terms of our ability to manufacture anything from clunky stuff like boat anchors, I mean literally clunky, to very sophisticated things like smartphones. So much of that stuff has gone. Where we are, in my opinion, a great country, is in the founding ideals of our country, which were imperfectly, obviously, acted out at the beginning of the country. But keep in mind, you know, when John Locke in 1674 wrote his second treatise on government, or when Thomas Hobbes in 1634 published Leviathan, the beginning, arguably the intellectual beginnings of the Renaissance, or of the Enlightenment, excuse me, in 1776, we were just 100 years into that. We were like three, four generations into questioning the possibility of the absolute handed down conventional wisdom that humans are evil, that humans can't govern themselves, that a divine class of beings who have genetic superiority are the appropriate leaders of countries, kings and queens, that they come from unique families that have unique capabilities, thus all the interbreeding of the royal families, and that they rule by virtue of both terror, you know, by the power of their army, and terror of the afterlife, the power of their religion. And we rejected all that stuff, or much of that stuff. Now, a lot of it we've readopted in other ways, and I think, frankly, right now our oligarchy is a kind of a new Calvinist rebooting of Victorian England. But it's not consistent with our DNA, and that's what I think is unique about the United States. We also, to the best of my knowledge, arguably, I suppose you could say Canada maybe share some of this with us, but we're also a country, if you can for a moment set aside the genocide of the Native Americans, which is damn hard to do, but you virtually have to for acknowledge this, which is why it's kind of a mixed blessing, but. We're also one of these countries. We're also a country where you are an American, not as a consequence of who your ancestors were 500 or 1,000 years ago. In other words, you know, a Swede will say, I'm a Swede because, you know, my family's been here in Sweden for years and years and years. And there's a racial identity that's associated with most countries that in the United States, I mean, yeah, we've had white Anglo-Saxon Protestants basically running this country for a long, long time. But that's been breaking down. It's been breaking down since the Civil War, and it's starting to break down even faster now. And I think that that's a really good thing. So I think that the ideals that this country was founded on, and that we might be able to recover, and that we did successfully recover to a large extent in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and, you know, with the New Deal and with the Great Society, I think those ideals are still alive in the hearts and souls and DNA of Americans. And our job, this generation's job, our collective job, from people my age to people, you know, just coming up out of their teen years, is to bring America back to that. Am I making sense, Doug?
Well, yeah, I follow everything you're saying. What your statement kind of implied, I mean, your statement in the past that it's the greatest country in the world, kind of implied to me is that in certain ways it's greater than other countries.
Well, if I have ever said, and I, you know, it's not inconceivable, But typically what I would say is that America is the greatest country in the world for Americans. And I say that having lived in Europe for a year. I lived in Germany for a year. And I thought that I was just going to be in America, only everybody spoke German. And what I discovered was that it was just a deeply different culture. I mean, the culture shock there was so much that after a year, I just had to come back. I was so homesick for America. And I think Germany is the greatest country in the world for Germans. And Sweden is the greatest country in the world for Swedes. And you know, each country has its own way of being exceptional. So I doubt that I would place America as at the absolute apex.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
That said, we have historically been a major leader for good things in the world, and this deal with Iran, for example, might be another example of us doing that sort of thing. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Back to my my theory that the Republican Party is made up of rich people, shills for the rich people, and suckers. Sam Brownback in Kansas, of course, radically cut the state income tax in that state. The Koch brothers live in Kansas. And threw his state into basically a depression by imposing Reaganomics. It's an absolute screaming disaster right now in Kansas. And so what does he do? He just signed a bill into law that lets anybody with no experience whatsoever carry a concealed loaded weapon anywhere in the state with no permit. Right? Anybody over 21 who is not, you know, prohibited from owning a gun by virtue of presumably being a felon or something like that. It's like, oh, the economy's going down in flames. We did, however, you know, give hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks to the billionaires, but the people are getting a little upset because the economy's going down in flames. So quick, let's talk about guns. I'm telling you, it's rich people, shills for rich people, and suckers. Steve in Seattle. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love your show. And I've read a few of your books. I read The Crash of 2016. I really like that book a lot. Anyway, I was doing some historical research, and I realized that you can go back. What is it? Like, your theory is like every, 80 years or
roughly.
So, there's a big crash, and then a kind of a renaissance, right? There has
been. Historically, roughly every 80 years, an economic crash brought about by a generation, a couple of decades of just uncontrolled, insane greed, becoming ascendant, because the people who remember what happened last time this happened are all dead. So you have that.
Right.
That brings about an economic crash, and then that economic crash positions the country or the world for war. And typically, so 80 years ago, we had the crash of 1929, followed by World War II. 80 years before that was the great crash of 1856 or 57, followed by the Civil War. 80 years before that was the crash of 1700, followed by which led to the Tea Act of 1773, which led right to the American Revolution in 1776. And you want to go 80 years before that? Do I have that right?
Yeah, approximately. It's actually more like 100.
Okay.
But, it's still more or less like a generation's time. There was, before the Revolutionary War was the 30 Years' War back in Europe in the 1650s, I believe. And it was one of the bloodiest, worst wars in European history and involved a lot of countries. And it was a lot over religion. And it was a total crash. And then it took about 5-10 years for the Age of Enlightenment to take off.
Right.
And that was about 90-100 years before the American Revolution.
Interesting.
And I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. The book on this, or at least my favorite book on this topic, and we credited them in Crash of 2016, is by Strauss and Howe, and they wrote a book called The Fourth Turning. And it's about how there are these four generations that seem to repeat themselves continuously in Western society and presumably in other societies as well. You get a generation of people just to pick a random point in that four-generation cycle. Let's say we started with the generation of people who experienced the crash and the war, okay? And then out of them, they give birth to a generation, or their children become a generation of quiet builders. They basically, you know, put the country back together after the war. They put things together and they make things happen. And that was, you know, largely my dad's generation, the 50s, you know, the 40s, the 50s. And then that generation of people give birth to a generation that says, you know, our parents worked their butts off, and this is all they got was this T-shirt. You know, we're not, you know, but because the quiet builders did a good job, the generation that follows them, which would be my generation, says, you know, hey, life isn't all that bad. Things aren't all that hard. We don't need to, you know, have any kind of violent protest. Instead, let's dive deep, you know, and this became the LSD and the whole spiritual thing and the Maharishi. And if you go back, you know, the last cycle around, it was the Transcendentalists and Emerson and Thoreau. And you see this in every cycle. And then that generation gives birth to a generation, which would be my children, who say, you know, mom and dad sat around and stared at their navels all day long and it didn't do any good for them. And so let's get rich, you know, let's make some money.
Yeah.
And they then start engaging in activities that are risky economically, and they crash the country. And so here we are back now to the next generation, which has to deal with the crash and the war.
I think that all makes sense to me. That totally makes sense. But I also agree with, you know, what you said before, that people just forget.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so frustrating to me, because my dad was a total World War II buff, and tell you anything you want to know. And I got to be where I know a lot about it, too, and FDR. And it's just tragic to me that people don't remember what FDR did and what was going on back then. And that fascism was popular here, too, for a while.
Yeah.
You know, there were people in the 30s. Who called themselves fascists in America. And it's just sad that people's memories, we don't know our history good enough.
I agree.
That's why I like that book of yours quite a bit.
Well, thank you. Yeah, there's a lot of history in the crash of 2016. Thank you for your kind words, Steve. And you know, hopefully this time around, we can either mitigate the crash or mitigate the war, or go into both of them with our eyes wide enough open that, I mean, each war has been horribly worse than the past, right? In World War II, millions and millions of people had died, and we had atomic bombs. In the Civil War, it was the bloodiest war in American history. The Revolutionary War was pretty awful. Each war, because of advances in military technology, essentially, each war becomes worse than the previous one. Hopefully this time around, if enough of us are talking about this and enough people wake up, as these events unfold, we might break the cycle. That was one of the reasons that I wrote the book. Steve, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. John in Lakeland, Florida. Hey, John, what's up?
Well, good morning, Tom. How are you this morning?
I am.
You know, I know you have heard. I know you've heard this time and time again, but thank God for you, Free Speech TV. Amen. And the programming of Free Speech TV, because it's my opinion that it gives an opportunity for the people in this country with some thinking to listen to and to share opinions.
Well, thank you, John.
My thoughts are, if you just sit back and look at what's going on, we are in my opinion, we're in a microwave. Our society is in a microwave, and the temperature is being turned up. We are being cooked, and we don't even realize what's happening.
It's like the frog in the pot metaphor you're talking about.
You got it.
Yeah.
You got it. And I remember this program, this movie called A Face in the Crowd. And if you look at that movie and the time and the science of the time that it was in, it was so prophetic, because it spoke to the future, and the future is now. Mm. And if the Republicans and the Koch, all those people probably saw that same movie, and the principles that movie espoused are being used to deal with the mass population. And if it wasn't for a fluke of a twist of fate in that movie, this guy would have and gone on and no telling what he would have done. But a fluke stopped him. And I think at this point, it's not a fluke. It's real.
Yeah.
When you get a population and you have the power to make people vote against their interests, it is craziness, in my opinion. It is insanity, in my opinion.
Oh, they're crazy like a fox, John.
Beyond that, because it's hurting the population, and it's hurting us. And I think that we need more than talk. I mean, you're great, but your voice is a cry in the dark. When you've got these major media markets that is continually just turning people's minds away from their interests and not giving them relevant information. And we're being led by that. Well, some people are being led by that, but the people that listen to your show is not being led by that. So the question is, and it's a rhetorical question, what needs to happen to change the population's mind and to deal with our political situation? I think we live in the greatest country on earth. And it's not the country that's the problem. It's the leaders that's the problem. When you got people who are permitted to come on the airwaves and they've got millions and millions of listeners, and it's irrelevant how Fox continuously talk about Benghazi, continuously knock our president, who, and I know I'll get some blowback, but I think that President Obama, in my opinion, is the greatest president in my lifetime.
Yeah.
But the problem is the airwaves continue to knock him.
Yep.
And people continue to listen to that. That's the problem. Yeah. It's the greatest country. But if you've got people that are saying continuously, that he's not, people are believing that.
Yeah, I'm with you. John, these are what you're describing. These are not like evil people problems. These are structural problems, many of them created by the Supreme Court and created by this bizarre libertarian philosophy that money and rich people should rule everything. John, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archive.
And we really need to wake up from this fog. And history tells us that the thing that typically wakes people up is a major economic crisis, unfortunately. And welcome back. Gary in Chicago watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Well, today's Good Friday, Tom.
It is.
And businesses are closed. Offices are closed. And so that gives it some recognition. But the significance of Good Friday is diminished. People no longer want to establish religions. You know, they make up their own stuff. But it eliminates the importance of Good Friday. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to get into that for just 2 seconds, okay?
Sure. Go for it.
Okay. So when Jesus obeys the law of God and then dies for the penalty of sin without having committed a sin, he can now forgive sin. That gives it balance. And we can become his workmanship, okay? And that gives us access to higher realms, okay? I don't believe that we're bound by the earth plane, that we can move on into greater realms, and Good Friday gives us that access.
Hmm. So in your theological worldview, there are sacred days where the doors or the walls between dimensions are a little thinner or more open than at other times. Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is that when the biblical story of Adam and Eve, you know, not obeying God, God had to set into motion a plan to restore fallen man to himself.
Right.
We're a fallen race.
Right.
And so in order to reconcile ourselves to God, Jesus has to leave. You know,
no, I'm familiar with Christian theology and the storyline of that. And by the way, that it's not unique to Christianity. I mean, it was part of Zoroastrianism. It was part of numerous religions that preceded Christianity, too, was that we were somehow fallen. And for some reason, so many of them say that we humans are fallen because of a mistake that a woman made. And then the for thousands of years, both the religion and the culture use that as an excuse to oppress women. This is the story of Adam and Eve. You know, Eve screwed up And then she was cursed with, you know, pain in childbirth and you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I think these are, frankly, you know, I understand the need for creation stories. But I think that these creation stories that have the woman as the bad person and the man as the either the good person or the unwitting victim.
Not at all, Tom. Tom, let me. Okay, we're just a speck in the universe. And so what God does is he tests people in this realm, and now there's another planet in another solar system and another universe. So they're telling us now that there's a universe beyond this universe. And so it's elimination. God tests people. Some people listen. They go on to be, you know, unfallen, you know, beings. Our Adam and Eve decided that they wanted to be as God and ate the fruit that God told them not to eat. Now we're a fallen race. And so it's just a matter of, you know, elimination. God puts a test here, a test there. Some societies, some civilizations succeed. Others fail. Ours failed. And now he set into motion a plan to restore us.
Yeah.
And
so well, it's
a Good Friday.
Okay. And Gary, I don't share your entire analysis of your theological worldview, but I respect it. And I wish you a good Friday. May it be a blessed Good Friday for you. Thank you very much for the call. And to our Jewish friends, it's the beginning of the Passover, and it's the beginning of Sabbath. Once the sun goes down tonight, Shabbat Shalom. To our Muslim friends, I think Juma Mubarak is how you wish someone a happy beginning of the Sabbath day. I have to learn more of that language. We will be back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by thanklist.com/watch. Who are you thankful for? To see an example, you can go to thanklist.com/watch and see the story of Sholene and Kier, the slave from South Sudan. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in the world today?
Secretary of State John Kerry today dismissed critics of the interim Iran deal. He said this is the most extreme and intrusive inspection structure of an arms control agreement, that we have entirely new mechanisms to be able to gain access, inspect, hold accountable for what's happening in the years ahead. He said those people who criticize it like that, they don't have an alternative. He also said, of course it could fall apart. What we did was open a window to a possibility.
Yeah. And any word from the 47 traitors?
Senators who signed an open letter to the leaders in Iran have spoken out fairly vocally about this deal. I don't know whether Senator Mark Kirk, Republican of Illinois, signed that letter or not. But he yesterday gave probably the best quotation of the day when he said that Neville Chamberlain got more out of Hitler than Wendy Sherman got out of Iran.
Do you think that there's any truth to that?
No.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to me like that's not just hyperbole. That's slander.
Yeah, I don't think there is truth to it. But he also said something else rather interesting. He is one of the people who's been very involved in this sanctions bill. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he is regarded as a moderate. In fact, he's the fifth Republican senator who's just come out to support Loretta Lynch for attorney general. He also said that he doesn't expect them to vote on the sanctions legislation until June. He said that yesterday.
Right.
Now, that's interesting because there have been a lot of rumblings that they're going to vote on this legislation and that basically that would scupper the deal. He said, no, I think we'll give them till June. That's interesting that he says that in the same interview with the Daily Beast as he's also saying the Neville Chamberlain thing.
Yeah, yeah. Have the Koch brothers, has Americans for Prosperity weighed in on this, or are they sticking more to things like, you know, trying to stop the expansion of Medicaid in Tennessee?
I have not heard anything from them or from any of the various PACs or anything so far. I imagine some of those quotations will come down, if they're going to come down, in the coming days. So far I'm hearing from people like, you know, Kerry, Hassan Rouhani, the Iranian president, vowed today that Tehran would honor the terms of a deal if the other party does. Netanyahu today said his cabinet is firmly behind the against the framework deal. He said that the Israeli cabinet is united in strongly opposing the proposed deal, would pose a grave danger to the region and to the world, and would threaten the very survival of the state of Israel. So we're hearing from people like that right now and from other senators. Quite a lot of Democratic senators and representatives also have concerns about the deal. I think one of the things that surprised a lot of people was the specificity in it. Yeah. There's been a lot of talk in the days leading up to this that what the Iranians wanted was a fuzzy statement. And this is a, really quite a specific interim deal.
I think the President Obama knew, and you know, just the politics of it here and domestically, that if they didn't lay out a deal that any common sense American could read and go, wow, that's a pretty good deal, that they were going to get, they were going to be in trouble.
I think so. And you've had surprising people saying that it should be given a chance. I can't remember the exact quotation. One of them was Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah, which surprised me. I have not yet actually seen his comment. I just saw the headline on the story, but it was like, oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
So what else is up in the world?
Well, it wasn't a good month for jobs numbers in March. The payrolls rose by 126,000 jobs, according to the Labor Department. It was the smallest gain since December 2013. They've been gaining over 280,000 jobs a month for the last 3 months. They think it's partly because the economy has been stumbling in the first quarter. Both February and January jobs were revised down. They do think that March jobs were also hampered by the harsh winter weather. The unemployment rate also, which is derived from a separate survey of households, was unchanged at 5.5%. So it will be interesting to see what April does, where the weather will hopefully not have impacted it.
Yeah. On the other hand, the collapse in the price of oil has shut down a lot of drilling operations around the country, which is laying off lots of people.
Yes. 30,000 positions so far in 2015 in mining, logging, which includes oil and gas extraction.
Yeah. Remarkable.
Yes.
Other things going on?
Yeah, very interesting. Ray Hinton, 58, who spent nearly 30 years on Alabama's death row, was freed today after a decades-long fight to prove his innocence. He said, I shouldn't have sat on death row for 30 years. All they had to do was test the gun. Basically, the crime scene bullets were the only evidence that linked him to the crime. Prosecutors wouldn't retest the gun, even though the attorney who took his case 16 years ago pressed that. For years, officials refused. And basically, the Supreme Court ruled last year that he had inadequate counsel, sent the case back for a second trial. Prosecutors were going to retry it. Then they didn't after they finally tested the bullets. Found, oh, he didn't do it. His constitutionally deficient representation was his defense lawyer thought he only had a grand to spend on a ballistics expert. So he hired the only person willing to take the job for the money who wasn't any good. In fact, he was so bad that the jurors laughed as the defense expert struggled to answer questions on cross-examination.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
His lawyer said today he was convicted because he was poor.
I guarantee you this is not the only story like this in America.
No, there are organizations trying all over the country to free people.
Yeah.
Interesting story today that someone connected to Hillary Clinton signed a lease on a campaign office space in Brooklyn, out of which the organization is going to run its national campaign.
Oh, very interesting. So they're moving ahead. Victoria Jones.
She has 15 days.
Oh, great. Victoria, have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
Thanks so much. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Who are you thankful for? To see an example, go to thankless.com/watch and see the story of Sholene and Kier, the slave from South Sudan.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Happy Good Friday and beginning of Passover and Juma Mubarak, and all those, all that. It's a pretty important day, I guess. And it's Anything Goes Friday, so picking up your calls. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, you want to talk about political parties?
With regard to an earlier caller, I mean, I think that it's wonderful to have a diversity of views out there. But when you want to call in and tell me that, for instance, a major incident in terms of international relations, such as the shooting down of the Malaysian airline, and then you want to offer an internet site that quotes some supposed air traffic controller's tweets
right.
as a counterpoint to the mountain of evidence that points to the Russians as having been the ones that shot down that airline. I mean, one needs to balance these things. This is why
I don't disagree, Steve. Although the mountain of evidence isn't that the Russians shot it down, it's that the Ukrainian rebel, Russian speaking Ukrainian rebels shot it down using Russian made equipment.
Right.
But I don't disagree. I respectfully disagree with Wayne on that. I did look it up during the break. I read the two articles about the Spanish controller who left and said he took the tapes with him. Maybe not. I have no idea. And that was why I said, as I did at the end of that conversation, that it almost doesn't matter that the larger issue is, you know, has to do with NATO on Russia's border, and that goes back to the Reagan and the Bush administrations. And Mikhail Gorbachev, and that's where we're going.
And that's an important point. However, I think that when people begin to make a point and with sort of a ridiculous argument to begin with,
it sometimes hurts their own argument. But I can't.
Right.
I'm not here to make sure that every single one of my callers says everything exactly the way that it should be said on radio or whatever. And you know, Wayne's a very thoughtful guy and a very well informed guy, and strongly holds his beliefs, and most of his beliefs and worldview I share. This is one in specifically where I'm doubtful. But anyway, is that what you call it?
Well, no. In terms of the question of whether or not, you know, the United States, you know, is violating some sort of an agreement. Yes, there was an agreement made over 30 years ago. And the question now is, do we then deny the right to enter into NATO, these other nations, simply because there was an agreement between two individuals 30 years ago?
Right, and we've already blown up that agreement. You know, we blew that up when Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania joined NATO.
Right, exactly. And now the question becomes one of, to what extent is that membership somehow a threat to Russia?
Right.
I mean, with all due respect to the Russian people, I mean, there is a paranoia within Russia that has been there for hundreds of years because of their history. And this idea that simply because NATO is on your border, that there's some secret plot in the near future that somehow troops are going to come over that border and Russia's going to be invaded, which is, you know, beyond the pale in terms of reality.
Well, it's actually happened in the lifetime of living Russians, Steve.
Right, exactly. But the idea.
So it's not a paranoid fantasy. It's a horrible remembered reality.
That's predicated upon the notion that NATO and the United States are somehow akin to Hitler.
Well, no. The whole point of NATO was to stand against the Soviet Union and all of their satellite countries. It was a coalition, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It was a coalition of countries that. Essentially, were the good guys and the victims in World War II, excluding the Soviet Union. I mean, this was kind of the reversal.
Well, you know, they had the Warsaw Pact. They there's with the alternative
correct.
To the Warsaw Pact. So
correct.
Again, so
and,
now,
and but see
in mind that NATO,
the point that I'm making, Steve, is that after the end of the Cold War, why didn't we reinvent NATO?
Oh, we did. NATO is as much a cultural and economic body today as it is a military, which is why so many nations want to be a part of NATO, because of the huge economic benefits to being a part of NATO.
The only economic benefit is that you can buy weapons.
No. That is absolutely not the case. When you in fact join NATO or become a part of NATO, there is a tremendous investment in terms of the benefits in terms of what you get when there is a military relationship.
That's my point. The benefit, you know, any exchange. any country that says, you know, if we join NATO, we're going to see our GDP go up, it's going to be because they're getting NATO weapons. They're getting, you know, they get to play in the war games. Is that really the way that we want to spread prosperity around the world?
And those troops get to need to be fed. They need to be housed.
Exactly.
All of those are economic benefits.
Well, yes and no, Steve. As one of the things that we know, I mean, you know, kind of Econ 101, is that war is incredibly stimulative to economies over a very short period of time. That when you're feeding your soldiers, when you're building bombs, when you drop them on somebody, you drop those bombs on somebody, or when that military equipment gets built, and then whether it's used or whether it becomes obsolete and gets destroyed, it's gone. Whereas if you took the same amount of money and used that money to build hospitals, to build schools, to build highways, to build high-speed rail, to build high-speed internet, to invest rather than spend, you're going to get orders of magnitude return on your investment. Whereas military expenses tend to be expenses. You spend $1 billion on military, and you may make back a few $100 million in the secondary sources that you're talking about, but you're not going to make back $5, $6, $7, $8, $10 billion over the course of the next decade or two. You spend $1 billion on educating people, and we learned this with the GI Bill. You spend $1 billion on educating people, you're going to make back $7 billion in additional tax revenue over the course of their lifetimes.
But it's not an either-or proposition. The nations that have joined NATO in the post-Cold War era have not invested largely in terms of their own security. Instead, they have benefited from the security that NATO provides as an umbrella entity.
Sure.
So it's not as if Estonia became a part of NATO and decided, you know, let's just go ahead and dump a bunch of money into our military.
No, no. My point is it's our money. Much of NATO is being paid for by us.
Exactly. And part of the reason that a lot of these nations want to be a part of NATO, again, because there is a lot of other benefits sent beyond military. And secondly, the threat, to the extent that it exists, is the fear on the part of these nations of Russia, given its history with regard to these nations.
Well, I think what was the year when Russia last invaded Western Europe?
Well, I mean, that's the Second World War. If you don't count...
Are you sure? Russia, you know, Russia didn't invade Western... I mean, you know, that was a response to Hitler. I mean, the last time the people came out of the Caucasus Mountains and swept across Europe was 2,000 years ago. It was the Celts.
Wait. Are you referring to the Russians? Because if you're talking about the Russians, in the Second World War, Stalin and Hitler agreed to slice up large portions of Europe, including Poland. So before Hitler decided to turn around and get the agreement with he and Stalin, they together, acting as allies, invaded Poland.
Right, which lasted, what, a year?
Well, yes, exactly. And then again, we don't count. Are you not counting the Russian military aggression in Hungary in 1956 and in Czechoslovakia in 1968? Who do you think was responsible for this?
I am not here to apologize for Russia. Number one. Number two, that was not arguably Russia. That was the Soviet Union.
Right, exactly. The Soviet Union.
And our great hope was and continues to be that Russia can and will reinvent itself in a more democratic way. And I think that we could play a positive and constructive role in that process. I think that we really screwed the pooch when the Soviet Union fell apart and we sent a bunch of Chicago school boys over there to show them how to privatize everything. And suddenly, you know, Russia became basically an oligarchy. It had all these billionaires come about as a result of, you know, Reaganomics in Russia. Steve, thank you for the call. You're right. It is a complex situation that doesn't lend itself well to bumper stickers. We'll be back. 15 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I guess the main point that I would make is if we want to be a force in the world, shouldn't we be a force for education and health rather than war? Welcome back. Jim, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Andersonville, Tennessee. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to bring to your attention something that hasn't been getting hardly any local press and certainly no national press at all, and that relates to the TennCare story that you did in the first hour. Mm-hmm. One of the things that our wonderful Republicans did here in addition to that was, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but there's a hole in the 10-care law, I mean, in the ACA, that says that insurance companies are only allowed to raise your premiums by 10%. And here's where the gotcha is. The second part of that says that without state approval. Well, last year, I'm on an ACA plan, and last year I went to renew my plan, and my plan jumped up 30%. And, of course, the subsidies don't increase. So, in effect, I had a 50% increase in my ACA plan, which forced me to take a cheaper plan with higher deductibles, and it still cost me $100 more a month to do that. So I see this as an existential threat to the ACA in that if they keep doing this every year, eventually there's going to be a boom of people in this state that have no insurance because if my keeps are going up 50% a year, I can't afford insurance anymore.
Yeah. I think your experience is assuming that it is as you characterize, and I'll believe you. Certainly the exception rather than the rule. We know that in general, healthcare costs, health insurance costs, have been going up at the lowest rate over the last 3 years in the last three decades. So, you know, there is something positive happening as a result of the ACA.
I agree with that. I'm totally behind the ACA.
It's an imperfect law, but it's a beginning. The problem is that you've got between the Supreme Court taking a bite out of it and then the individual states trying to mess with it, and now you've got the Koch brothers getting themselves involved in blowing up. You know, Republicans trying to do the right thing, trying to give 280,000 low-income people in Tennessee coverage, in your state, in Tennessee, coverage, and they were ready to do it. The Republicans were ready to do it. They'd figured out a way that they could do it where they could run it through the corporations so that the corporations could skim enough money off the top that they could kick some good contributions back to those Republican politicians. And the Koch brothers came in, or Americans for Prosperity came in, and shot the thing down. And that is, you know, who elected Americans for Prosperity? How is that American democracy?
Not me, that's for sure. Yeah. And I didn't elect the guys that allowed the insurance companies to jump my rates by 30% either. But
well, that would be your state insurance commissioner, and my guess is, and I don't know this for an absolute fact, but I believe it to be the case, that provision in Obamacare that says that the state insurance commissioner has to sign off on it is basically a Tenth Amendment issue. It's that, you know, the individual states still have the final say in a whole lot of things. And if they have a state insurance commissioner who is overseeing insurance in that state, then that person has the final say, or has to have the final say. We used to have that with regard to things like credit, remember? And back in the 70s, Nixon changed, or during the Nixon administration, they changed those laws so that there were no longer individual states regulating banks and regulating credit card companies. So all the credit card companies went to North Dakota because they had the laxest laws. And, of course, that's one of the solutions the Republicans are offering is, you know, let's sell insurance across state lines so that we can do away with state insurance commissioners who typically hold these companies honest. Jim, thank you for the call. We'll be back. You can just put me on the air and off we go. Welcome back. Our music croaked, but I'm still here. So, you know, that's a fine thing. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, I'd like to tell you what I consider the scariest thing about America's aging nuclear power plants, especially the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant here in California.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to Google or your favorite search engine and type in the words nuclear vessel beltline, NUCLEARVESSELBELTLINE, and then the word embrittlement, EMBRITTLEMENT. So it's nuclear vessel beltline embrittlement. And the key here is the term beltline. The beltline is the region of the vessel that directly surrounds the active core. And there's sufficient neutron radiation located at the beltline to cause reactor damage in the form of embrittlement and cracks. And here in California, This is earthquake country. We're part of the Pacific Ring of Fire earthquake zone, and we are constantly told to prepare for the big one, a Fukushima-like magnitude 9 megathrust earthquake. And Diablo Canyon is only designed to withstand a magnitude 7-point earthquake. And Diablo Canyon is 30 years old, and that's 30 years of neutron bombardment, making the reactor's belt line as fragile as glass, and it's susceptible to containment loss and nuclear meltdown. So that's the thing that I fear the most about nuclear. It's the belt line on the aging reactor's vessel, the
right.
belt line area.
And on top of that, Harvey, because of Price-Anderson, because of this law that was passed back in the 50s to make nuclear power possible in the United States, because it is so dangerous, there is literally no insurance company on earth, not even Lloyd's of London, that will write an unsubsidized liability policy for a nuclear power plant. That should tell us something. So we're subsidizing Diablo Canyon, and we're subsidizing all these other nukes, and if anything happens, we are going to pay the price. They are not. And, you know, yeah, they do have some secondary insurance and things, but Price-Anderson is the big backup. And if we did away with Price-Anderson, all these nukes would just have to close down, and that would be a good thing, in my opinion. Harvey, spot on. Thank you for the call. Bob in Bob won't. Where are you calling from, Bob?
Oceanside, New York.
Great. Thank you for calling.
This is the first time I've ever gotten through to your program. I've called many times, but I'm not a person with great patience. I have a million things to say, and I was going to talk about something else when I was screened by the individual and making the call. But what I'd really like to talk about now is voting rights.
Okay.
I think, as a progressive individual, that voting should be mandatory, as it is in some countries. And I think one should have the ability to vote against a candidate if they can't find somebody they want to support for a candidate.
Or a none of the above?
What's that?
In other words, none of the above should be one of the options when we vote?
No, I didn't say none of the above. I said I want the ability to go into the voting booth. If I cannot find a candidate's support, I would like the ability to vote against candidate.
So your vote would have the effect of subtracting somebody else's positive
exactly.
vote.
Exactly, and then the country would really see whether we really have people who are running that are really wanted by the public.
Right.
I think you'd find that would not be the case in a lot of cases.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. We've got a larger problem we have to deal with first, Bob, and that is that our political candidates are not behaving in the way that the American people want. I mean,
Well, that's for sure. But you know, this Republican Party, I've said that we face more of a threat from the Tea Party in this country than any threat from the Middle East, from Middle East nations threatening this, that, and the other. Okay, and that is a real problem. And I think what you said before that progressives have to band together, but I see a lot of weakness with Democrats. I've always seen that people—they're not willing to throw a punch. Okay. And there's a lot of weak candidates. I mean,
we need people like you in the Democratic Party, Bob. Show up. Become a precinct committee person.
Well, I do show up. I only voted in the last election for the first time because I've been a self-employed person my whole life, and nobody was going to pay me if I had to serve on jury duty. So I voted for Obama in the last election, and I support Obama.
Yeah, this jury duty thing, that's a huge one. You know, We need to decouple jury duty from voter registration because I think that, you know, what you just said.
There are problems in this country. The legal system is horrendous in this country.
Yeah, and it's true. A lot of people don't register to vote because they don't want to do jury duty, and you know, which is
that's true.
Very important.
As in my case, as I said, but they also don't have. If you had mandatory voting, you wouldn't have any of this voter suppression, and I think
you're
voter
right.
suppression is anti-democracy.
Yeah.
And why do we have people supporting anti-democracy? This is supposed to be a democracy. And another thing, you said this was the greatest country in the world. This is a great country, but let me tell you something. There's no country that's been involved in more wars than this country. Every opportunity to go into war, this country gets into. So I guess the military-industrial complex has something to do with that.
I think they have.
I don't want to take too much of your time. I'd like to call again and bring up a different subject.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Bob. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Ken in Ticonderoga, New York. Hey, Ken. Thanks for watching DirecTV. What's up? Quick one.
Hey, Tom. 72 and sunny. Siberian polar vortex is over, at least for today.
There you go.
And so, the reason I called, a couple of things. Earlier in the week, you were referencing the Department of Defense, blah, 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 in respect right. to Iran. And just, you know, because words matter, right?
We used to call it the Department of War.
Yeah, exactly. At the very least, let's start us anyhow, Tom Hartman down on the left, start referring to it as the Department of Offense. Because when you got upwards of 1,000 bases worldwide, plus the world's largest navy, plus the world's largest nuclear submarine force, plus black ops sites, plus CIA sites, you can't call that defense.
Yeah. Well, I think going back to the old Department of War might be more reasonable. Offense might cause a few people to scratch their heads, but I get your point, and it's a good one. Yeah. Ken, thanks a lot for calling. Thanks for watching. We'll be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And you can drop into our live chat room over at tomhartman.com. It's free. It's fun. Drop in and say hi. Fair and only, slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I was going to talk about something else, but it is Anything Goes Friday.
And feel free.
Something that I've been thinking a lot about since this thing in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
Now, let me preface this by saying I don't think sexual identity, I think you were born with your sexual identity. But if it is a choice, what difference would that make? I mean, would we get to discriminate against people for making that choice?
Right, right. It's, yes and no, Anita, because we do actually have in our society literally thousands of areas where we discriminate against or in favor of people based on their choice. Somebody shows up for a job interview well-dressed versus poorly dressed. Yeah, you're going to, you know, as an employer, you're going to react differently toward them there are restaurants that require
discriminate based on who they choose to love or who they choose to marry or who they choose to have sex with or how they choose to have sex.
Well, that's a good point. Those are far more personal decisions. Yeah, your question, I think is a much stronger than just a rhetorical question. If let's say that sexuality was a choice, so what? Excellent question.
Yeah. I mean, there could be no other freedom, I think, more important than that our identity.
I think the thing that sets that aside is a necessary question, although for people who are bisexual, and there are people who are bisexual, they ultimately at some point probably are making a choice. But
yes.
The fact of the matter is that most people can identify for you how old they were when they started noticing the difference between genders and which gender they were attracted to, and as opposed to feeling affiliated with. And typically, it's between 5 and 10 years old. I mean, it's, you know, with people as little kids.
I agree. I don't think it is a choice, but that's not my point. Yeah. The argument a lot of people make is, oh, well, they chose. I mean, I heard the father of that, or the pizza owner, that said they weren't going to serve, you know, gay weddings,
right.
Which is ridiculous anyway, because who has pizza at their wedding reception?
Right.
But
exactly. Who knew, right?
Yeah, who knew, right? But he said, I choose to be heterosexual. And
right.
They chose to be homosexual.
Right. And I would suggest that guy did not choose to be heterosexual, that he knew that from the time he was 5 years old that he was heterosexual.
If he feels like he had to choose...
if he says that he chose,
bisexual.
He may be one of those bisexuals. You're right. You're right. And for that small group of bisexual people, it is a choice. And I think that maybe a lot of these, you know, the Larry Craig type homophobes, the people who are clearly conflicted about their own sexual identity and yet are opposed to gay sexuality, I think, you know, they've they've made a choice and they're very uncomfortable with the other half of their personality, or the other piece of, you know, it may not be half, but the other part of their personality that is available to them as a choice.
They live in fear of that ever, you know, of that
choice asserting itself.
But most of us don't have that experience. I don't remember ever thinking, am I, you know, or I'm going to choose to be heterosexual.
Right.
Or.
Yeah, it was.
So if I felt like I had a choice, then I would probably be bisexual.
Yeah. Well, and you know, people experiment in things and figure that out. I mean, when I was a teenager, I experimented with a friend who was gay and say, hey, you know, let's try this out. I didn't like it. And, you know, so I figured out I was a straight guy. I mean, it's just, I was actually very attracted to gay culture, as it were, to the idea of society, of a group of people who were kind of a persecuted minority and were hanging together. And you know, I had a lot of friends, and I was actually involved with what was it called at that time at MSU?
But even then, and a lot of people do experiment like that. But then it's not even, that's not a choice that you made. That's just, you figured out that's who you are.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's called growing up, in my opinion.
Right.
So anyhow, good point.
I just wanted to ask that question because I just can't figure out why it would matter.
Yeah, yeah. Good point, Anita. Thank you for calling and making it. I appreciate it. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, how you doing? It's been a while since I've heard your voice.
It's been months, and the question I have to you, Mr. Hartman, am I through being punished for not being a Duke team player on your show?
I don't know. Have you been being punished?
Well, apparently you don't know who runs your communications. I haven't been able to call in. I've been blocked out for like 5 months.
I know that you were fairly abusive toward one of our folks who was answering the phone.
That's
would
not objective.
I to the best of my knowledge, you haven't said anything on the air that I would ban you for, but you know.
I called it the way it turned out to be truthful.
Okay.
In opposition to your little pitter-patter party there on Ferguson.
All right. So what's on your mind today, Armin?
What's on my mind?
I mean, you're on the air, right?
Okay,
you wanted to call. You wanted to be on the air. Here we are.
To you. Tom, here's my question to you.
Mm.
Obviously, you're intelligent. And obviously you study enough and you're intellectual enough to know what the protocol is about how the power structure works as far as this country goes. So my question to you is, do you not just tell the people explicitly what they're really up against, because then they'll just lose all hope and they'll go hide in their beer and their marijuana and their TV shows and whatever else they do?
Armin, have you read The Crash of 2016?
I've heard excerpts. No, I haven't read the full thing. What about it?
I
don't want that to happen. Let me tell you why.
Because
if you look at who's really pulling the strings and who runs the show, I think that they'd love that more than anything, because they think there's a real good chance to pin it all on Obama. And then there we lose the chance of getting a Democrat in, slowing the ship that's headed towards hell.
I don't disagree. They've been trying to do that for 6 years. They've been trying to crash this economy so that they can blame it on Obama. They all want President Obama to be Herbert Hoover. They're trying to Herbert Hooverize him. But, you know, I think I do tell it. Armin, in response to your earlier question.
They want corporate feudalism. They want corporate feudalism. That's exactly what they want.
It's what they've got, too. But
they don't want living wage, no retirement. They want 10 people for every job, because then they won't have to worry about unions or resistance.
Yep.
These people are beyond evil. These people make the Nazis like a damn Sunday school.
Well, no. The Nazis. And we still have Armin. Thank you for the call. It's nice to hear your voice after a while. The Nazis were not good people, and there is. You know, yeah, what is Goodwin's Law? You know, if first person mentions the Nazis, loses the argument. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind today?
Hey, hi, Tom. Three quick things. Bernie 12-point plan. I think the number one thing missing that should be at the top is taking over the Federal Reserve. He says he's going around the country trying to see what the people are feeling. I think the people spoke very loudly on no bailout in 2008. If he want to get the people to rally, he could say, it's time for our bailout. Let's take over the Federal Reserve.
That's one. Okay. The other one is, why we don't hear anybody question the climate deniers about the ozone hole? Anybody can deny the lesson learned from that? That's number two.
Yeah, it kind of blows up Jim Inhofe's theory that the world is so vast and God made it, and you know, in such an incredible way that there's no possibility that human activity could be harming the atmosphere. You're absolutely right. We've been through this.
More patience than me. I wouldn't listen to them guys.
Yeah.
Let me get number three in here real quick. You said you lived in Germany.
Yeah.
What was the deal with Hitler's mustache? He's the only one you see with that little short mustache. People should have knew automatically this was a weird dude. So why did he make a law saying he's the only one allowed with that little short mustache?
No, that mustache was actually a popular mustache in the 19-teens and the 1920s. Charlie Chaplin had that mustache here in the United States. I mean, that mustache was like, you know, it was a totally acceptable, very fashionable way for men to look. And if you look through old photos, you know, go into secondhand stores and you find all these old family photos that have just kind of fallen into the boxes, you'll find those mustaches on people right up to the 1930s. But then Hitler, just like there used to be a lot of people whose last name was Hitler, right? And there aren't anymore. I mean, all the Germans whose last names were Hitler changed their names after World War II, and everybody who had a mustache shaved it off or grew it out beyond the edges. So
I was just wondering, because I look at all the old newsreels, and all you see is him with that mustache. None of the other soldiers or his people with him had it.
No, he was the fashionable, you know, he was the civilian leader, as it were, you know, the chancellor, and they're in the military. And in the military standards did not allow, I don't believe, facial hair. I could be wrong, but yeah.
Let me get a quick one. What was your biggest culture shock in Germany?
It was how different people respond to each other when they do or don't know each other. There are different ways of saying the word you. If you are friends with somebody, like really close or related to them, you say du. Whereas if it's just like, you know, somebody in a store, somebody you just met, you say see, S-I-E, as you. And if you use the wrong form when you're talking to a person, it can be an incredible insult. And we had a couple that we were friends with. They were she was a nurse and he was a bookkeeper, and we went out to dinner every night for months. And finally one night they brought a bottle of wine and said, "You now have permission to use do when you talk to us." We celebrated the fact that we became friends. It was a pretty intense thing.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I know a lot of languages have those gender-based forms and the personal and impersonal forms, but it's really in that culture. Welcome back. I'm taking a nap. I forgot it's not the top of the hour. Scott in Canaan, Maine. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom.
Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
A couple of things, real quick, and I'll say it as fast as I can, and so you can, I'll just get it off the air. In reference to your format, you know, I'm like 60 years old, and about the time, I think it was probably around the seventh grade for me, somewhere back in the late 60s, they stopped teaching civics in school. I mean, they just quit because of budget cutbacks or whatever. I don't know. It just disappeared. And I would like to see you for maybe the first half hour of your program, just pick a president or a dissident or somebody that has something to do, you know, with the development or growth of this country, and just start giving people lessons in civics.
Well, that's an interesting idea, Scott.
As a country, we have absolutely forgotten the heart and the soul of what the very first word in the Constitution is. And because of it, we've fractured.
Right.
We're a fractured society.
Right. That word being
we have forgotten that word and what it means.
Yeah.
And
I agree. You know, and I do try to every day look for something that I, you know, one of my, our criteria when we put this show together, Louise and Sean and I and some of the other folks who help us out, is every day I would like my listeners or my viewers to have at least once have one of those forehead slap moments where they go, oh, my God, I never knew that. Or I knew that, but I never understood it that way.
You know, you should make it mandatory.
Just well, and we try to do that every day, and then we put them up on YouTube. We do cut this program up into little pieces, and
yeah. Or even take it as a suggestion.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, but if you check out our YouTube channel, I think you'll find an awful lot, a large number.
I don't
of
have a computer, Tom.
Okay. Well, then, and also I've
had one other thing too.
Go for it.
Because I know you're running out of time. Why is it that we only have? I mean, there's 5 times as many of us now as there used to be. Why is it that we only have one day to vote now? Why can't they make that like a weekend thing or a 1 week deal?
Well, most states have.
Sure everybody has the right paperwork, et cetera.
Right.
I mean, there's like 350 million of us now.
Yeah.
You know, versus whatever. Almost, yeah. You know, I mean, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, the population of the U.S.
is. That be a week.
Has just about doubled.
I'm going to hang up and let you go, dude.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Scott. Thanks for the call. Yeah, our population has just about doubled since the 50s, and you know which is substantial, and there's a lot more of us with regard to the vote. I don't know. It's you know what was his name? The guy who started the American Legislative Exchange Council, Paul Weyrich. As Paul Weyrich famously said, you know, he doesn't want everybody to vote. Republicans can't win if everybody votes. He said, in fact, quite candidly, our leverage in the elections goes up as the voting populace goes down. And so we're always going to have Republicans fighting against our ability to vote. And I think that that's one of the things that really, you know, we need to be paying attention to. There was another point that you made, but I've lost it. Sorry. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan, Danielle Gilday, Troy Miller, Rachel Calvert, and Lori Lewis, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at all the companies that syndicate our program, Westwood One, Pacifica, SiriusXM, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, to the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, hello, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and most importantly, to you. Thank you for supporting our program. Thanks for letting folks know about it. Thanks for letting our advertisers, if you're listening to us on commercial radio, using their products and letting, you know, whatever station or outlet or however you may be watching or listening to the program, letting them know that you're listening. Thank you. Jimmy in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. Hey, Jimmy, what's on your mind?
Yes. Hello, Tom. How are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Jimmy. How about you?
Oh, I'm the same. Appreciate it. Well, I appreciate you talking about the Medicaid expansion as much as you do. I think it's so important. And I really believe that in those states that the people that are being denied Medicaid, they should send their emergency room bills to their governor and to their state house demanding Medicaid to pay that. It's just a shame. A shame that they're having to go without medical coverage.
Yeah, it's beyond a shame. It's morally, it's a crime in my mind, Jimmy.
Yeah, yeah. They should send it to them. They should stand up to them.
Yeah,
hospital.
The problem is that in the case of this woman that I started out the show with her story, Tracy Foster, she's actually dying of bladder cancer right now, or she has bladder cancer, and if it's not treated, it will kill her. And her doctor will not do the surgery to remove it without a $2,000 check, and the hospital will not let her use the hospital for the surgery without an $8,000 check. And that's basically just the down payment, and she doesn't have the money. So it's not like she can go in, get the work done, and then submit the bill to one of the idiots in the Republican legislature in Tennessee. Or to Americans for Prosperity, who spent all that money running all those ads defeating you know, TennCare, the expansion of Medicaid in Tennessee, she's probably going to die. And so are a lot of other people, 280,000 people with no health care and no access to health care in the state of Tennessee. It's a disaster. Jimmy, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Chadwick in San Francisco. Hey, Chadwick, you want to talk about about choices?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a longtime listener. I love your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to call because you had a caller a little while ago, Anita, that called, and you talked about choice. And I totally agree with your point that if being gay was a choice, what difference would that make? Why would that matter? And I just wanted to add to that discussion that what I think really highlights the hypocrisy of that argument is that religion is itself a choice. The thing that's at the center of this debate is something that people choose and people change all the time. So for
You're
them
right.
to say that being gay is a choice and therefore we should be able to discriminate against them is ridiculous considering we have protections against
You're right. If you were to graph it as a basic, quadratic equation or algebraic equation, you could say, okay, choice of religion then causes you to say that you can discriminate against somebody based on their choice of sexuality, really? And because they're making a choice about sexuality, but you're making a choice about religion doesn't matter. That's your point, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, I'm with you. And like I said, other than for people who are bisexual, I don't think that being gay is a choice. But in fact, I'm quite sure it's not. But or straight for that matter. But the other variations. Being transgender.
And I am gay, and I can tell you for sure that it was not a choice. If I had a choice, I probably wouldn't have chosen this. To be honest, considering how difficult it's been in my own life.
Yeah,
it's a ridiculous thing to say that someone would choose to put up with the crap that we have to put up with.
There you go. Chadwick, thank you very much for the call. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. Excellent point. Robert in Albuquerque, listening on KABQ. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Thank you for taking my call. The reason that I'm calling is about mandatory voting, and you had mentioned that you didn't think it would be possible to have an incentive. You couldn't pay people to vote.
I think it would be unconstitutional.
Right, exactly.
But I may be wrong.
Unconstitutional. Well, I was thinking that one of the options, I have two ideas. One is that it could be one of the choices on the ballot could be I choose not to vote. And so then people would be eligible to get getting some sort of incentive just for showing up.
Right.
And you would still not know if they voted or not. All you know is that they were at the polling booth and put something in the machine. The other thing I was thinking, though, is that the government wouldn't have to do this, but it could possibly be individuals or an individual or a number of individuals pulling money together to create some sort of a lottery.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that would be eligible to win the lottery would be people that had voted, which is a public record.
In other words, putting a positive incentive. I see Al on the board in Chicago. He wants to point out that in Illinois, voter registration is not tied to jury duty. I was going to say, what we need to do if we can't come up with positive incentives is get rid of the negative incentives, that being jury duty. Apparently, Illinois has done that. But this is, if we could come up with a positive incentive, as soon as you attach money to it, you're back to the issue of is it the reverse of a poll tax or something like that? Are we trying to influence people to vote in a particular way? I mean, Republicans have argued for years and years and years that the reason Democrats passed Social Security was to buy the votes of people over 65. I call that democracy. I call it, thank you for the call, Robert. I call it doing what the voters want, right? That's how it's supposed to work, right? Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today and all this week and all these years for many of you. And we will be back Monday, same time, same place. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It really does require your participation. So get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you online.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.